Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Thursday, December 31st, 2015. It's the last day of the year. Wow. With me today, I have John Martellaro. How are you, John?
Cold. It's 16 degrees here, 8 days below freezing. Trying to stay warm.
Yeah, I feel your pain, your chilly, chilly pain. It's cold in Boulder also.
But it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad you're here. I'm also really glad that Jim Tanis from Tech Review is here today. How are you, Jim?
Gentlemen, I am doing very well on this New Year's Eve, and I'm very glad to be here as well. Thanks for having me, as always.
It's great to have you here, and I'm feeling pretty special because I'm now in the presence of two incredibly brilliant people. So that's a great way for me to wrap up the year.
Who else is here? Jeff, I thought it was just us.
Oh, yeah. Look behind you guys. I invited some other people. Yeah. Anyhow, I thought that we could start today with an interesting bit of news about Apple and diversity. There is a shareholder. He has over 600 shares, and his name is Antonio Avion Maldonado II. And he has put forward a shareholder proposal that Apple be required to increase the diversity in its executive level hires. And Apple, they've been resistant to putting that on the ballot for shareholders at the next meeting, which would be in 2016. The SEC has now come out and said, you know, we kind of agree with Mr. Maldonado, and we think you should put this on your ballot. So Apple is now in an interesting position where they don't want to do this. SEC thinks they should. And now we have the issue, what's up with Apple's diversity? So that's why I wanted you guys here, because I thought you'd be able to bring some nice insight.
Well, when a company is working for profit and they're in a very competitive environment and they're trying to hire the very best people they can find, this is just an irritation. Plus, I kind of got the feeling from the situation that Mr. Maldonado is part of that psychology where you so love the company that you want to insinuate yourself into its affairs and become part of it. And it's kind of a fan-based meddling thing. That's my perspective on it.
Yeah, and I think and these types of issues are always tricky because, you know, in a headline, it sounds like it's a clear-cut thing. More diversity, that's generally good, right? But with companies, as John said, you know, for-profit companies and companies regulated by the SEC with shareholders, they're generally want to be a well-oiled machine, and they have to adapt within their own internal ranks as well as face outside pressures. And you don't ever want to put onerous requirements on them from shareholders. And in general, what you'll see, I mean, this is not an unusual type of request. It's popular or in the news now because it's Apple, but a lot of shareholders will attempt to put restrictions or put requirements on boards, and those generally don't go very far unless there's some serious problem with the company, because you want the very best and brightest. You don't want the company to have its hands tied when it's trying to make a quick decision using its best judgment. And so if you don't like the direction of the board, you elect new board members, and then they make the executive changes. It's not on the company to put this kind of, or it's not on the shareholders to put this kind of restriction on the company. And the reason Apple is resistant is not just because they think it'll win, it probably won't, but it makes it look bad, because if they put this on the ballot and the shareholders vote it down, somebody out there is going to come up and say, oh, look, Apple doesn't care about diversity. And it's true that they look from a distance to be very minimally diverse. And when there was that 60 Minutes special just before Christmas and they showed all the executives in that boardroom, it was like a sea of white. But when you think about it, you know, they've got an openly gay CEO, they've got several women in high paid positions, and it doesn't mean that they're perfect. They still have a ways to go, but this isn't the approach to take.
And this morning in our staff meeting, Brian Chaffin made an interesting observation. He goes to the shareholder meeting every year.
He has an almost imperceptible share in Apple's stock.
Yes, But he's able to attend, and he commented that the shareholders are generally in favor of the way the executives at Apple run the company, and even if this gets on the ballot, it won't be approved, in his opinion. And I think he's right.
I think he's right also. And for the shareholders, I think what it comes down to is money. They're making good money, and Apple is doing their job in such a way that they can get these dividends. And when everything's working really well, you don't rock the boat. So I think that that if this does end up on the ballot, then Brian's right. It will get voted down by the shareholders because Apple doesn't want it. But Jim, you brought up an interesting point. This now becomes sort of like a Kobayashi Maru for Apple, because they don't put it on the ballot, and now it looks like Apple is, at least superficially, against diversity. If it goes on the ballot and it gets shot down, then it looks like Apple is against diversity.
Yeah, that's the reality of when, you know, these types of situations occur all the time in personal lives and in politics, and it's super easy for someone to fixate without context on one interpretation. And if you sat down and you thought about it for 2 minutes, you know, you'd understand what the real situation is, but people don't do that. You know, there's a whole bunch of people out there who are critical, overly critical, unfairly critical of Apple, and they're going to take advantage of this, even if it's just for a petty cheap shot. I mean, this isn't a huge deal, but they're going to take advantage of it. And so it puts Apple in that no-win scenario, and there really is no easy way to get out of it, because it makes sense to not have a measure like this. It makes sense to not even vote on it. But the what do they call it? The optics of the situation from the average consumer's perspective will be temporarily negative.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Now, the other concern that I have is that, let's say this goes up in front of the shareholders, they vote it in. Do we at that point need to start worrying about whether or not Apple is hiring the right people for a job, or are they hiring the people that will just simply keep them compliant with this new guideline that they are bound to?
I was thinking along the same lines as you were, Jeff. Does this kind of initiative stem from a heartfelt belief that this is going to improve Apple's executive management?
My guess is that the answer to that is yes. People think this will improve Apple's management. And when you get a more diverse board, an executive team, especially when these people are all competent and qualified for the job they're doing, I think overall you have a stronger leadership team, because you get a wider diversity in perspectives on just the world in general. And mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing. But if you are putting someone in a job simply to meet a quota, and I have seen this in businesses I've worked in the past, where people are hired not because they were the best person for the job, but they were the best person that met the requirements that needed to be met for some sort of diversity program. And sometimes it worked out fine, and other times it didn't. What I found was that it didn't matter how light or dark your skin was, or what gender you identify with. It was just a matter of who was the best at the job, and if we could get whoever that was to do the job, then it was great. And I've seen businesses where someone was hired to meet a specific type of quota. Like a gender quota, and then the person started going through gender reassignment. So then it kind of messed up their quota.
That's an interesting situation. No, I mean, and these are the challenges that affirmative action like policies create. And the reality is that even the strongest affirmative action proponent recognizes some of the disadvantages of a policy like that. But the point is, generally, there are positives that counteract or that we weigh against the negatives. It's just, is that a, you know, is that important in this context with a for-profit company, you know, that already, again, we're not talking about old, having everyone be an old straight white male. There's already quite an impressive level of diversity in many ways in this company. You know, is this the approach where we're going to accept the negatives that may come with this type of policy for some perceived benefit? And is that benefit going to, in the long run, outweigh this? Or, you know, I mean, I don't view this company as being discriminatory. In fact, right, quite the opposite. And so I don't think there's a problem. I think the reason there's not as much diversity is that it's more of a close group. And that's probably a bigger problem. This is a core group that many of them have been there since Steve Jobs returned from Next and even a little before. And so if anything, it's just that these are the same old people. They like to keep a tight-knit group. They like to keep a closed group and trust and veteran employees. That's more the problem, not that they don't want to hire someone of color or someone of a certain gender or nationality or ethnic background or whatever. So if those opportunities come up, I don't see any indication that Tim Cook and his leadership team are not going to pursue the best candidate regardless of those factors.
I agree with you. Yeah. Now, listeners, I'm curious, what do you think? Should Apple have a mandated diversity hiring policy for executive level staff? Let me know. You can hit me up on Twitter. That would be, what is it? TMO Daily. There's so many Twitter accounts I have to deal with. TMO Daily. You can shoot me an email, observations@macobserver.com, and you can leave comments in the show notes, and I'll be checking all those places to see what you say. And yes, I'm very curious what you have to say. Okay, now speaking of what you have to say, listeners, you gave us some feedback like right away to yesterday's show where John was talking about why he wants to see some new, like really serious app development tools and programming tools for the iPad, like you can actually use on the iPad. And part of that was because people that are learning to use tech gear today don't have the same opportunity that we had so many years ago, which is to learn how to program on our devices and learn more about how they work and develop additional like logic skills in the process. And so we have some feedback. Now, I'll start with one comment that actually came up a couple times, which is that it's not actually necessary on the iPad to have development tools because by the time people get out of school, the development tool or the development skills that they learned on the iPad will no longer be relevant because they will be out of date and not appropriate for the types of jobs they're having. So what do you think about that, John?
When I look at the industry and I see what's going on, from my position as an editor and also my wife as an educator and other friends and surveying the internet, I do a lot of reading. It seems to me like a lot of the jobs in the future involve programming, logic, things like robotics, Watson, artificial intelligence, big data analysis. Every time you turn around and you look at something and it involves coding, it probably isn't a job you can think of in the United States that's a white-collar professional job where you don't have to do some analysis and some coding. It varies from all the way from Lucasfilm doing computer graphics down to, you know, being a sales analyst and having to do spreadsheets and analyze your sales and do metrics on the products and so on. So I kind of disagree with that. I think it's a logic-born analysis, analytical, and scripting and computer programming-driven culture, in at least in the high-tech area.
Okay.
And without being, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to listen to yesterday's episode yet, and without being a part of that conversation and just going off how you set this up, my response to that would be, it's not about learning a particular development platform or a particular language.
Right.
It's about learning the logic of how to program. And everybody, I've never, I'm not a programmer. I took some classes. I can get by in some basic level of some certain languages. But the people I know who really went into programming, you know, you learn that first language. You learn to think like a programmer. You learn to understand how computers and how code interoperate. And once you've got that down, you can move from language to language with relative ease. I mean, there are obviously it's challenging, but it's that first one that's it's that first language, those first concepts that are the most challenging, and that's what's crucial. And I think that's what John intended in his article is and that's what so many people from our, you know, the older generations learning how to code. It was learning how to think that way, learning to appreciate how it worked behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And that's so don't get hung up on whether the language is going to be obsolete or the platform is going to be around. Just learn to code on any device and get those, you know, see if there's a love for it there. And if there is, you can move easily on to whatever the latest thing is.
Well, speaking of love, Jim, what coding does, I think, is invites you to envision what you might achieve and what you might do on the computer. So many adults, excuse me, don't have that vision formed as a young person because they weren't in control of the computer. They didn't feel like they could make something happen. They didn't feel like they could solve a problem. And from the interviews I've done so far on background mode, the theme and the thread that I'm learning is that people started with these baby steps and it launched from there and it grew. And they almost all started with a technical and programming background, and then that led to something, and that led to something, and that led to something. But if you just treat the iPad as a fun device, as a consumer device, there was a picture in my article yesterday about a kid with an iPad, and the question is, what's going on inside his brain? You know, is he just responding and playing games and responding to the environment that's thrown at him, or is he digging in and having fun and researching and figuring out what he can do and make stuff happen and building and refining his brain into a logic and problem-solving engine, you know? So that, and the iPad had to be designed the way it was in order to be successful. But the problem is that now, with so many young people using iPads, they're not being exposed to that environment. And I'm not saying, as a clarification, that programming per se is the ultimate thing and that you must do that to be a technical professional. But what I'm saying is that once you start having a relationship with the computer, once you start seeing how it works, once you start manipulating data and files and making things happen, that a spark occurs generally. And then you launch from there. And that sort of ignites your intellectual growth and your relationship to computers in general. And it happened to me, and I've seen it happen to other people. And I think that if the... now that the iPad is 5 years old, plus it's time for it to grow too. I had a wonderful reader, Rick Allen, point out to me that there's some restrictions on the file system. How do you program when you can't see files and manipulate files? But you know, there's probably a ways around that too, where you program on the iPad, but you access an external file system. So there's hybrid ways to learn how to program a computer. To program an iPad.
Mm-hmm. Now, we are almost out of time, but I'm glad you brought up the positive side, and Rick is definitely in the positive camp there. So thanks for the feedback there, you, Sir Rock. And Rick and a few other people offered up suggestions for apps you can get right now to do some level of programming on an iPad. And what I found is that there are more apps available right now than I expected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's starting to get really fun to explore all this. But the message here is that out of the box, the iPad doesn't present that to you. But if you do a little digging, and I'm going to be doing some digging and writing articles, there's a wealth of, not a wealth, but there's a more material, like you said, than we thought. To help young people get started with the learning to program on an iPad.
Yeah, which is absolutely awesome.
There's even a way to run Kano OS on your Raspberry Pi and do a VNC direction of the output to your iPad. So you get to use the iPad as a display for your Raspberry Pi. I'll be talking about that next year.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hey, and we are out of time. So speaking of next year, which happens tomorrow, next year is also when CES happens. And that's coming up in just a couple days. So I'm going to be there. Dave Hamilton and Brian Chaffin will be there with me. And we are going to be doing, just like we did last year, all of our TDO episodes will be from CES. So we'll be giving you daily updates about all the interesting things that we are encountering at the show. So be sure to listen in all week, and if there are products that you're interested in learning about, let me know, because I'm going to be there. I can check stuff out for you. Jim, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks again, guys, and Happy New Year, everyone. All my best for a safe and healthy and happy 2016.
I think that sounds like an awesome plan. Let's all have a great and safe 2016. John, thank you for being here.
And you have your CES assignment from me, 4K and HDR.
Yes, I do.
Have at it.
Yep. And listeners, you get a little bonus next week because Jim is going to be covering the news desk for us so that we can actually be on location at CES. So, Jim, thank you for stepping up and helping out.
Thanks a lot.
Really scraping the bottom of the barrel, guys, but I'm glad to do what I can for you.
Well, I think that it's a very high quality barrel. We're scraping it, just so you know. And
it's organic.
It's organic. That's it. Yes, listeners, thank you for being here and for sticking around all year long. You rock. We will see everyone again after New Year's. There's no show tomorrow because it's New Year's Day. So we will see you again next time from Las Vegas and CES.